This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and me, Alex Knight.
Last week, we talked a little bit, about WordPress. Unfortunately, nothing bad has happened this week. In fact, I perused the WordPress forums looking for issues, and I didn't really see anything major. In fact, I set up a MAMP environment and tested the theme with the current plugins that I have, and everything was fine. And before I upgraded to 4.4 on production, I made a backup of the database as well, because now I'm like super worried. I mean, I don't think being unreasonable or paranoid, it's just that I should have been doing that before and I had not done that.
Yeah, that's always the best policy, because every update for WordPress may introduce breaking changes to plugins or to the database or whatever. Usually they try to warn people in front of that, but I mean,
well, not everybody pays attention either, right?
Exactly. So. And I mean, that's kind of another nail in the coffin for the existing setup for the plugin ecosystem. Because, WordPress can just release a big update and then suddenly all the plugins are broken. It's happened quite a few times. Not lately, but for a while there, they would release like big updates and then suddenly plugins would stop working.
What's going on this week? I don't know. Do we even really want to talk about the iPhone case? Cause that's going to annoy a lot of people. Cause I know that just every tech outlet has decided to write these long pieces breaking down
Apple
the case.
Is doomed. They don't care about design anymore.
If you don't like it, don't buy it.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of the hump on the case, but I understand why they did it. I understand what the goals were for making a battery case. They wanted a case that would be reasonably slim, that would not interfere with the antenna, which apparently a lot of people had no clue that battery cases were actually causing this issue, because the battery covers the entire length of the phone from top to bottom, right?
Yeah.
It's certainly better looking and slimmer than a Mophie.
Oh, easily. Every Mophie case I've ever had has turned my phone into a beluga whale. So I actually got to try the new battery case in the Apple Store yesterday. They brought out a demo unit for me to try out, and it's actually really good.
It's expensive, though. Very expensive.
Yeah. Super expensive. But the hump, quote unquote, is actually a lot thinner in person than it appears to be in the product shots. Like, the product shots really, for whatever reason, accentuate the size of things. I guess it's kind of like the Apple Watch product shots that made everything look massive, but then you actually have the device and it's like, wait, this is it?
What about the LED indicators that seem to be on most battery cases? Does it have anything on it that you can tell what kind of charge it has?
There is a light, but it's inside the case, and that's if you're just charging the case. When it's plugged into the phone, you actually get to see the battery level of the case and the phone right on the lock screen.
Oh, that's interesting. And so that's, I guess, one of those advantages of being an Apple product. The integration with the hardware and software is nice.
Exactly. And they didn't even have to release an update. I don't know when they added it in. Maybe it was 9.2. Maybe it was in there as early as 9.1.
It must have been earlier. That case, they must have been designing that like 6 months ago, easy.
Yeah. I'm just thinking like the software support, because I've been running 9.2 for a while. I plugged my phone into it and it showed the two battery meters and I'm like, whoa, okay, cool. I don't know if anyone's tested it with 9.1, but yeah. Either 0.1 or 0.2, they added the support for it. So you plug it in and it just works. And they've sort of done things differently in that the battery cases, other than this one, act on a paradigm of you can turn the case on and off. So what people usually end up doing is they run their phone until it gets to zero or near zero. Then they turn the battery case on to charge the phone, and the case depletes, and then you have to charge the case, and it's like this big cycle. The problem with that, though, and probably why Apple didn't do it that way, is that you end up running way more battery cycles using your phone that way, because you're constantly letting it deplete, and then you're charging it back up and letting it deplete and charging it back up.
Which, by common knowledge, everyone, well, a lot of people know that you shouldn't really be doing that with lithium ion polymer batteries.
No.
They'd like to have some level of charge in there.
Yeah. And you'll wear the battery out a lot faster if you do things that way. The case companies don't tell you that, or maybe they do in some FAQ somewhere, but the way people are using these cases is not great. So the way the Apple case works is when the case is plugged in, it acts as the battery for your phone. The iPhone battery is not used to power the device whatsoever. And then when the case runs out of power, the phone battery starts to deplete. So it's like a reserve tank of gas.
Mm. It's expensive, but that sounds like something I'd be willing to actually fork over the extra cash, because I know Apple did it right so that it wouldn't mess with the battery cycle and the lifetime.
So that's clever. It has a lightning port pass through, so you can still use all of your accessories with it.
No dealing with micro USB cables like the Mophie.
Yeah. If you have headphones, you may need an extender. The Apple AirPods will work normally, but for me with my RHAs, it did not fit into the slot. So I would need an extender. So that's kind of a deal breaker for me, but your mileage may vary. I think it's a great idea. Okay, it doesn't look amazing, but for what it is, it does a great job, and it actually makes the phone really comfy to hold. I picked up my phone when it was in the case, and your hand just kind of wraps around it, and the hump kind of creates this natural little shelf on either side for part of your hand to rest on. So it ends up being really grippy and comfortable as opposed to the other cases, which are a little more slippery.
I'm at a loss as to why they only released it in two colors, charcoal and white. After all the variety of colors that they had with the regular leather and polyurethane cases.
It's a little odd, but the way they've described it, they don't intend for the case to be used all the time. Their suggested use case is that you would put it on the phone if you're going on like a hiking trip or an extended business trip or something, like somewhere where you're not going to be able to charge the phone as often. And I mean, from that standpoint, it makes sense. Like, why should you have to constantly keep a reserve amount of power with you at all times? Like the way I do it currently is I have battery packs, and I only bring those with me if I know I'm going to need them, if I know I'm going to be away from a power outlet for a while. And that's not very often. So Apple's case works on the same principle. So I don't know that it needs to be 16 different colors if you're only going to use it once in a while.
Fair enough. I think that's all we can really say about the case, because it's not really a complex thing. Either you want it or you don't.
Yeah.
And that's about it. But I actually have a question I've been meaning to ask you with all the hoopla over or rumor about Apple discontinuing the analog headphone jack on the iPhone, because I know, I don't know if it's going to happen on the iPhone 7. I mean, none of us know, but I'm just thinking, I gave it a lot of thought this week, and being an audiophile, and of course I know you are pretty much an audiophile, I think it's very clear to us to understand the benefits of going with a digital signal is that I think it's inevitable that they will eventually have to do it because of the benefits. There's so many benefits in getting rid of that. It's not just a space saver so that they can include battery. It's so that you can get better sound. And I haven't heard very many people talk about the benefits from a sound perspective of going with, let's say, headphones that maybe use a lightning connector, which would be pretty great.
Yeah. Or even wireless with an updated Bluetooth spec.
Well, as long as it supported BTLE 4.2.
Yeah.
Anything else than that is really just garbage.
Yeah. Got to have that battery life.
Well, it's not just battery life. It's connectivity, stability.
Yeah. The bandwidth as well. You definitely need a high bit rate. So the old Bluetooth doesn't really cut it.
Well, I just don't want to have to pause the audio on the little remote mic and then wait for 3 seconds for the iPhone to catch up to the wireless signal.
Yeah, that's my favorite too. That's why I haven't really bothered with wireless headphones yet. I mean, the sound quality on them is getting better, but yeah, they're still really slow. And as for the headphone jack, I think Apple really just wants to focus on what can we do to make this a better product. And part of that is A, making it thinner. I know people will say, oh, but it's already thin enough, but you can always make it thinner. And one of the big obstacles to that is the headphone jack, because the size of the headphone jack cannot be addressed. It's as big as it is. And
well, it's practically as big as the, I'm just looking at it right now. Of course, listeners can't see this because this isn't a video podcast, but I'm looking at the whole of the headphone jack and it is basically top to bottom, taking up all of the width of the device.
Yeah.
So
they can't really make the phone any thinner with that headphone jack still there.
Besides, the analog headphone jacks are just janky. I mean, seriously, if you use them all the time, like sometimes if it doesn't click in all the way, then the audio cuts out. Like they short out really easily. They're just flimsy. They've never been great. No. I don't understand the love for the analog headphone jack. At least the mini jack, a 1/4-inch jack. No problem. I have no problem with that. The mini jack is terrible.
Yeah, it's not great. It's an old technology. It's what, 30 years old now?
It's like a vestigial connector from the, before I was born. So,
yeah. So it's ancient, and yet devices continue to still use it. But obviously, there is a better solution staring us in the face, and yes, it's going to be annoying. Yes, you're going to have to buy an adapter if you really love your old analog headphones. But ultimately, it's going to lead to a better product, because with Lightning, or as some are speculating, with USB-C, Apple is part of the USB-C working group, and it is possible they may switch to it. Just because USB-C also has the Thunderbolt 3 spec attached to it. So
it makes, and I honestly wouldn't cry for having Lightning go away on devices, because it's like, well, I've only got a couple of Lightning cables. It's not like we've all invested so much money into our lives with Lightning everywhere. I mean, really, not that many devices use it. So, and yes, I know the 30-pin connector wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
But you know what? If we have a better solution, then use the better solution.
My only other thought is, well, USB-C is actually quite big. Lightning is really slim in comparison. Apple could feasibly make Lightning the new USB-C spec, in theory.
But why would they do that? Because USB-C is reversible as well. So why not just use USB-C?
Because it's a much thicker connector than Lightning.
Okay.
USB-C uses a wraparound design where the pins are inside and it plugs in. Whereas Lightning, it's just a completely flat connector that just goes in. Like if you look,
you're right. It is smaller than USB-C for sure.
If you look at the new Apple TV, it's like, it's pretty obvious. I actually have a USB-C, adapter now for the Apple TV. It's huge in comparison.
Wait, why does the TV have a USB-C port on it?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Also, the new MacBook has USB-C. So it kind of feels like Apple's hedging their bets a bit. I'm not quite sure where they're going exactly. Like,
maybe they're not sure either, considering how many devices are, you know, split between USB-C and Lightning.
Yeah. It's definitely possible. As I said, they are part of the USB-C working group, so they do have a say in what USB-C is. It's going to be interesting to see what happens there because, yeah, Lightning is clearly a better connector, but USB-C is clearly a better format. Ultimately, it's going to end up being faster because you bundle Thunderbolt 3 in there, and you're getting way faster than USB 3 speeds.
Sure.
Plus better media transfer.
And I just want to say, going back on the audio quality topic that we started with,
right.
So the issue with an analog headphone jack is that the stuff that is inside the iPhone is digital. When you play a song, that signal is digital. It's a digital song on a digital device that has to get converted to an analog signal. So you have a DAC or digital analog converter converting that to an analog signal. Now, think about that. You're getting rid of the middleman. And now with a Lightning or USB port, or USB-C port, whatever they end up going with, will be a pure digital signal from end to end. How can that not be superior? It has to be.
Well, I mean, technically it would be, but obviously you'd get the same detractors who are like, well, like the same people that love vinyl, right? And me personally, I'm used to having really high quality headphones and those are all analog. So I don't want to have to compromise that quality to switch to headphones just because they happen to have a Lightning connector.
Right.
And
right.
This will be
presumably there would be some kind of an adapter though, anyways, to connect
Those course.
Old headphones.
But the only thing there is it would still require a DAC.
Right.
So Apple doesn't really save anything there because they would still have to support the old headphones, even if they do add an adapter. Like they're not going to put a DAC inside the adapter. Well,
see, but that's the other thing is that the DAC in the iPhone isn't going to be all that great. And if you have a super high-end pair of headphones, you're not going to get the best audio quality out of your iPhone. And of course, yes, you can get these external, you know, headphone amps that have better DACs and stuff like that in it. But that means like you've got to carry this extra brick in your pocket just to get better sound. Like, is it really that worth it to you?
Well, the DAC in the iPhone is actually quite good now. They've consistently upgraded it over the years. I think they still use Wolfson as the brand. But yeah, they consistently add like the latest version with every release. And
does the DAC feature Beats technology?
I hope not. They've pretty consistently updated it. And whenever I put my higher end headphones into the iPhone, it still sounds fairly good. Obviously it's not as good as it could be.
The biggest thing that I've noticed is that with good headphones, I have to crank the volume up all the way. The iPhone can't push enough power or whatever it is to the headphones.
The impedance. It doesn't have enough voltage to.
Yeah.
That
sounds right.
Like the impedance is basically like how many I forget what the measurement is, if it's milliamps or whatever. Like, basically,
it's,
how
it's usually ohms. Like, that, ohms. The preamp yeah. next to you there, there's an impedance knob on it when it's rated right. in ohms.
Yeah. So, whatever headphones require this many ohms in order to achieve, like, maximum potential sound output, essentially. And the iPhone is only capable of outputting this many ohms. So, if you have really high-end headphones with a really yeah. high impedance, the iPhone isn't going to be able to power them.
Right.
So even but at it's full not just volume, you're still getting like, you're still only getting like 60 to 70% of the maximum potential of the headphones.
And it's not just output volume. It's without the right impedance, you're losing like dynamic range as well.
Yeah.
Because you're not really getting the full potential out of those headphones.
Yeah. You essentially get a quieter, flatter sound if the impedance is mismatched. But to a certain degree, it ultimately isn't that bad depending on the degree of the difference. Like if it's a huge gap, if it's like 100 or more, then yeah, the difference is going to be very noticeable. But if the headphones are, say, like 100 ohms and the iPhone produces 90 ohms, unless you're like a really, really snobby audiophile, you're probably not going to be able to tell the difference. But yeah, getting back to the whole Lightning thing, I think ultimately you would have higher quality headphones. The problem, of course, is the migration. So for once they do this, and they're probably going to do this, it's going to take a little while. All the current headphones are all analog. So Apple would have to essentially...
All third-party OEMs would have to have access to, I guess, the licensing.
Yeah.
To build headphones. Like, you know, both of us have, you know, professional studio headphones on our head. So like they would have to start making those headphones available to professional people, and they would have to have maybe by default they would be digital, but they would come with an adapter if you needed to plug it into an older device that only had an analog headphone jack. So
yeah. It's and the only other thing is, if it's only Apple doing it, then it becomes a problem. Because, and this is where the Lightning versus USB-C thing comes in, because if they go with Lightning and if they say, oh, now you have to make Lightning headphones, how many OEMs are really going to redo all of their headphones just for Apple devices? Probably not a lot. Like Sennheiser and Audio-Technica, they're not going to go and make Lightning connector versions of their high-end headphones. It's not going to happen.
Well, not unless Android phones start adopting it and getting rid of the headphone jack.
But,
like, if it's an industry-wide thing that like everybody agrees that that's eventually what we're doing, is we're getting rid of the headphone jack.
Yeah, that's how you would do it, and everyone would have to agree on the same connector, or I mean at least agree that yes, we're going to get rid of the headphone jack, everybody needs to start making digital headphones. Like, if they could agree on that, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. The only thing would be that you'd have Lightning headphones and USB-C headphones, and then you'd need a Lightning to USB-C adapter, and it would get really confusing and messy. So this is why I'm kind of thinking that maybe Apple will switch to USB-C instead of Lightning, or they just make USB-C use the Lightning connector from now on. Either way, they would be circling the wagons around a single standard. That way everybody can say, okay, we're just going to start making USB-C headphones now, and it'll work with every device. Because then you avoid the problem of needing to make multiple SKUs for multiple platforms, and that'll just dilute the selection that's available to people. Because if your iPhone can only have Lightning headphones, that's going to be a very limited subset of hardware.
Yeah, but I mean, if an iPhone ships with an upgraded pair of ear pods that work with it, then you won't have to worry. Most people just use whatever comes with their iPhone.
I know, but it's terrible.
Yes, of course it's terrible, but we're both snobs, so
yeah.
Yeah. We're not
so,
most people.
Okay, so it'll be difficult for us snobs, but
right.
The average exactly. person won't be that bothered.
No, I'm just looking at the bottom of my iPhone again. I don't know how thick the USB-C port is, but I mean, there is some space on the top and bottom of that Lightning port. Like, could you not fit something slightly thicker? Assuming not, that you don't make the profile of the phone thinner.
Yeah, but you know they're going to do that. So,
yeah.
Like Lightning is basically custom designed in order to make a thinner phone. It's probably the thinnest connector that currently exists and possibly the thinnest connector that will ever exist. Because at some point we are going to switch to completely wireless connectivity. Like that's just going to be a thing.
Right. Wireless charging cables. Is ubiquitous and works flawlessly, then...
Yeah.
Then we'll switch to it.
But. Yeah. Like about 5-10 years down the road, we're not going to have cables anymore. But until then, Lightning is pretty much the thinnest game in town. USB-C is about twice as thick as the Lightning connector. And then the port for that is even thicker because it has to wrap around the USB-C connector. So
I'm sure Apple would love to get rid of all the ports on the iPhone because that means one less thing that can allow water to get in.
Yeah. Though they did,
they did make some improvements on the, see those videos of the iPhone 6S being dunked into a bowl of water.
They've made some improvements, but a patent was just found today or yesterday actually that is all about a self-healing elastomer cap for headphone and connector ports. So you would essentially stab the elastomer with the cable. It would stab through, plug in. When you plug it out, when you pull it out, the elastomer heals itself, creating a perfect seal again. Totally insane. But if it works, then you would have essentially a completely waterproof phone because all of the ports would be sealed until they aren't, which is crazy to think about. But
crazy, but awesome. I'd love to see the day that we have devices like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting tech. We've come a long way with metamaterials over the years. Like,
well, just even within the last year, I mean, the difference between the iPhone 6 and 6S aluminum strength.
Well, I mean, that's basically just a metallurgy experiment. And they already accomplished that with the watch. Like, the watch was Series 7000 aluminum. The phone is now 7000 series aluminum. So, yeah, they already knew how to make it. They just never bothered to use it on the phone until they realized, ooh, we've kind of made it so thin now that bending it is actually a problem, potentially. And looking ahead, if they want to make the phone even thinner, then you have to go with 7,000 or better. Because getting even thinner than the 6 design introduces a number of structural integrity issues that the previous aluminum probably wouldn't be able to solve. So,
when are the antenna bands going away?
That I don't know. That I'm sure they would love to get rid of, but until they either A, switch to liquid metal, or B, come up with an entirely new antenna design, I don't think they'll be going away.
But why switch? Why would liquid metal make a difference? I don't know anything about it. So
liquid metal is a customized alloy. There's some titanium, some gold, some other things. It's kind of like the metal that's in Iron Man's suit a little bit. Like, he describes his suit as a gold titanium alloy. And liquid metal is partially gold titanium as well. But you can have different formulations of it. And one formulation of it is radio transparent. As in, any modem signal inside the phone would go through the shell as if it were nothing. So you would have 100% signal quality without needing to create antenna lines or anything. It would just go right through the case.
That sounds like something Apple would want to use.
Yeah.
Are there any patents for that? Or
it's owned by this one company, but Apple for quite a few years now has exclusively licensed it for the use in smartphones. They haven't used it up until now. They used it one time to create a SIM eject tool. I think it was for the 4S or the 5. Since then, they've used aluminum for all of them. But that particular eject tool was made out of liquid metal. The other thing about liquid metal is the name basically explains what it is. You can mold with it. So you can, instead of CNCing aluminum, you can actually create an iPhone chassis mold, pour the liquid metal into it, and bam, ready-made chassis without needing to cut anything.
Does this mean we're going to have an army of T-1000 androids?
Only if Siri becomes sentient. But yeah, it seems to be a superior metal technology. But the fact that they haven't used it yet suggests that maybe there's some kind of issue with it. And then a while back, it seems like they let their license for it expire. So I'm not entirely sure what's going on there.
Maybe there's a cost factor as well, too, that they just haven't been able to figure out.
It could be. It could be. Obviously, aluminum is really cheap. Through economies of scale, through all of the orders they make, like at any given moment, Apple essentially owns all of the aluminum in the world, more or less. Like, once you've subtracted like tin foil and all the other uses of aluminum, what's left all basically belongs to Apple. All the other smartphone manufacturers have to basically fight over scraps if they want to make a phone out of aluminum.
Mad Max style, is that the world we're going to have? People fighting for scraps of metal?
Yeah. Like Apple basically takes all of it. Like all of the aluminum allotted for electronics, Apple owns it, basically. So as a result, it's really cheap for them to continue making phones out of aluminum. So for them to switch to a completely different metal would create a very high cost sink, because suddenly they would have to switch all of their fabrication to using liquid metal. They would have to get rid of all the CNC machines that they've invested in, swap them out for metal mold casting machines, like just a complete change to their factory workflow.
Well, it sounds easy. Just do it tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Foxconn will have it ready just like that, you know. part of it could be they don't want to spend the money because they haven't quite figured out how to make it just right yet, or there could be any number of reasons. The other possibility I've considered is if you look at the Apple Watch, where's the antenna?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it doesn't have any kind of cellular networking at all. It's just using, but it does have a Wi-Fi chip
and
in there
Bluetooth. And Bluetooth.
So it does have radios of some kind.
Yeah. So the secret of the Apple Watch is if you look at the screen and you look at the metal just underneath, you'll notice there's a very subtle gap that goes inward and curves around to the metal. That gap is where the antenna sits. So the antenna is actually partially out in the open, but hidden inside a seam that is essentially a visual illusion.
Like, so why can't they do that on the iPhone?
Exactly. So my thinking is they scale up this antenna design and come up with a way to hide the entire antenna in a gap between the curved glass on the front and the curved metal on the sides.
And that's ingenious, actually.
In so doing, they can create a completely solid aluminum chassis on the back. But because the antenna is in that gap between the metal and the glass, they don't need to worry because the signal just goes out of all the sides. In theory. I mean, I'm not an antenna designer. I'm not a... cellular signal specialist, but it seems possible to me that they could scale up the design of the Apple Watch antenna and put it into the iPhone. Obviously, with cellular, there are different concerns, but it seems plausible. So we'll have to wait and see. But either of those things could effectively kill the antenna lines.
And Johnny Ive will rejoice because it gnaws away at him every night.
It eats his soul and haunts his dreams, along with the camera bump.
Yeah, that camera bump, I don't know what they're going to do about that, because if making the phone thinner, how the hell do you get rid of that?
Yeah, you don't. You really don't. I don't know what they're going to do, honestly, with that. Like, that's the other big thing.
That doesn't bother me as much as the still slightly perceptible, if you pay attention, slightly perceptible gap between the screen and the glass. And you know I'm talking about this because you ruined it for me, because I have a white iPhone. And when you have a white iPhone, it's easier to notice the slight black border between the display and the glass edge. Yep. And the iPhone obviously is still one of the best displays on a smartphone. And it's certainly gotten better. And I know watching previous Apple iPhone product announcements, they've always talked about how they've done all this stuff to remove the gap between the glass and the display, so that effectively it looks like pixels sitting on top of the glass. But there's still more work to be done, clearly.
Yeah. One of the big things, I think, is going to be moving to an edge-to-edge display where there's no perceivable border around the screen. And part of that is moving to an OLED display.
Which has been talked about for quite a while. Yeah. I mean, I think there were rumors last year they were going to do it, but then they never did it. And then they also didn't do it again this year.
Yeah. I think ultimately they're waiting until the technology matures properly. It's not quite done yet. It's still very oversaturated. There's still issues with lifespan, ghosting, that sort of thing. Like, it's a lot better than it used to be. The original OLED was terrible. But
And I know this because I have a PlayStation Vita with an OLED screen, the older model, and when the screen's completely black, I can see these little streaks on the screen.
Yeah, so that would be the organic component starting to die.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much, I've had this almost since the beginning, and I've done research on this, and pretty much every PlayStation Vita to a varying degree has this problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which maybe is why they switched to an LCD on the latest generation. But the LCD is not as good. The whites are not as good. The blacks are not as good.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's really the thing about OLED. It creates a screen that effectively disappears inside the glass. And you can see that most evidently on the Apple Watch. The only thing with the Apple Watch is the screen isn't melded to the glass like it is on the iPhone.
Fused so, is the word. Apple
right,
tends to
yes.
use.
Fused. Right. So there is a noticeable air gap between the screen and the glass. But hopefully on the iPhone, when they do switch over to OLED, that'll be completely fused to the glass.
Right. Maybe they should have called the first gen Apple Watch the Apple Watch air gap.
Yeah, people have made fun of that. It's really not that bad.
No, like, it's absolutely not. It's a very nice display.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. The black level on the OLED that they're using is perfect.
Well, it's better than the iPhone. That's
it's
for
perfect.
Sure.
Like looking at this watch face, I cannot discern between the screen and the glass. That's how good it is.
Yeah, it's very so, very good black level.
Yeah. So when they carry that over to the iPhone and they make it an edge-to-edge display, it's going to blow people's minds, like a whole other level. And then with the software, it introduces a whole ton of things that you can do. Because OLED only uses power for the parts of the screen that are actually lit up, like the reason the black levels are so good is because black on an OLED display is literally the pixels are not on. They are just off. So that saves energy. That saves battery power. And one of the biggest power drains on the iPhone is the screen. So if suddenly they have a screen where if something is completely black, the pixels are off entirely and not draining power, they can start to do some really cool things. Like they can have a lock screen that kind of like Android, like with the Moto X, they can display just notifications. Like things can just float on the screen and disappear, and you only used power to display that one thing instead of the entire screen like we have currently. You could also feasibly have an always-on clock when the lock screen is closed. Like the iPhone just sitting here powered off, they could actually have an always-on display of some kind all the time, just because the iPhone battery is that much better than the Apple Watch. The reason they don't have always on for the Apple Watch is because it would probably cut the battery in half. But on an iPhone, they could theoretically display something on the screen all the time if they wanted to. Then, of course, the real advantage, saving power by having the screen be dark, it would necessitate the need for a dark theme for iOS.
That should have happened a long time ago.
If they really want to save power, then they have to change the aesthetic to a dark theme. Well, for the OS.
I don't think it needs to permanently change, but I mean, there have been plenty studies that say at night in the dark, that blue light that comes from our computer devices affects us when we need to be able to sleep. Yeah. So that's why one of the most popular jailbreak tweaks was it was a jailbreak tweak for a while. But
yeah.
The developer that did the Flux utility for OS X made app available for iOS as a side-loading app by Xcode, which, of course, quickly Apple put the kibosh on that. But there's lots of research that does say that there are a ton of benefits from changing the color of the display at night.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every app that I use that has an automatic dark mode, I take advantage of that. So Tweetbot has an automatic dark mode that it automatically adjusts itself based on the ambient light that's coming into the phone. And I also use Instapaper, which has an automatic dark mode, because there's no way in hell I'm going to read an article at night in the dark with a white screen staring at my face, burning my retinas.
Yeah, I always use dark mode. I never even bother with the light mode for a lot of apps where it's applicable. It's just so much nicer to look at. And
I think it's actually, it's easier on the eyes, but it's kind of a nice break from the sort of bland look that iOS has, like especially stock apps. They're just so bland. I've just gotten so bored of iOS as an aesthetic perspective.
Yeah, flat design is kind of...
Well, it's not just flat design, because Android M has that too, where they've removed gradients, but it's definitely more vibrant, fun
this,
looking.
This is something I've actually been talking about with some of my designer friends. The flat aesthetic is kind of on the way out. It's like this whole idea of everything being flat is just too much. And material design tries to overcome that by adding depth to things that have depth. Like it treats things as objects on a digital landscape. The only problem with material design is it goes a little too far and it gets a little too obsessed with this idea of digital paper. Like everything is made out of this magic digital paper material. And there's a little too much overthinking about that. And they tend to be a little inconsistent with transitions and things. Like they get a lot of things right, but they also get quite a few things wrong. So I don't think either approach is quite the right thing. And we've sort of noticed this in a lot of things that have come out over the past few months and just in designs that we're doing. I think the aesthetic is sort of moving towards this more modern kind of subtle skeuomorphism kind of thing. Like, obviously the old skeuomorphism was bad. Adding like super pebbly Corinthian leather to everything is a dumb idea. But things we can take away from the whole skeuomorphic principle: buttons should look like buttons. Buttons should not just be random text labels that happen to be a different color. Things should have depth if they're above or below something. A modal should have a box shadow. Like, just little things like that. And you shouldn't go completely flat, because it takes all of the character out of the design. You're essentially putting everything at the same level. There's no hierarchy. There's no sense of place. And this is something Apple's kind of started trying to put back into iOS, actually. They've been doing it more so with glass. Like, they've been doing blurs versus not blurs. They've been doing a lot of stuff with animation and transitions. I think we might start to see some depth come back to iOS a bit as they iterate.
I thought they were going to do that with iOS 9 and then nothing. Crickets.
Yeah.
Because I thought the whole thing about bringing Johnny Ive back in to have this more collaborative, one person has the say on the design, I thought they were going to kind of roll back a little bit that heavy-handedness of getting rid of so much,
well,
so much from the OS.
I don't think that was ever going to happen in iOS 9. iOS 9... was the let's make this a more stable OS again release. After the churn of iOS 7 and iOS 8, the platform was very unstable. There was a lot of crap everywhere. And iOS 9 was basically return to form. Like, okay, let's just slow down a little bit and fix all the crap. And for the most part, I feel like they've succeeded in that. As of 9.2, the iPhone, all the devices are really stable. I haven't noticed any major issues. There have been a few graphic bugs that other people have seen with orientation and the proactive section when you swipe left or swipe right. I always get that wrong. Like... People always go swipe right, swipe left, and I get confused because I always think, like, well, my thing, like, people treat it as swipe right is you're swiping your finger right, and I see it as swipe left because you're swiping the content so that what's at the left comes onto the screen. But anyway, that's like a whole thing I have, but... If we're going to see any major design changes to the UI, I think we'll probably see them in iOS 10.
Well, kind of makes sense. I mean, nice round number, right? I mean,
yeah.
It seems like, I don't know, the expectation would be that that would be a big update. But of course, people also want stability too.
Yeah. And that's really the fundamental issue with iOS. It's like, sure, they can add all these features, but then they break stuff along the way and the platform becomes unstable. And they did a lot of that in iOS 7 and iOS 8. Like, all the changes to multitasking, all the extension stuff, the share sheet, the new UI, like...
Handoff support.
Handoff, AirPlay, all the new stuff. They added so much and it was a breakneck pace. Like, they just kept adding and adding and adding, and they didn't take a step back and go, oh yeah, we should really QA a lot of this. So they eventually fixed the worst of it, but everything was still kind of buggy for a while. And iOS 9, I think, really focused on getting back to a place where, you know what, this is pretty solid again. But yeah, I think iOS 10, it'll probably pick up. And they'll start looking at more things. I think on the horizon, we're probably going to have more iPad features. They're going to try to differentiate the iPad a bit more from the iPhone. I think we'll see more stuff around multitasking, more stuff around the split view. We might even get multi-user support, which is something that iPad users have been screaming for forever.
Well, especially parents. I mean, I have no use for it, but I can see... Or I can understand at least why a lot of people would want that.
Yeah, because the iPad is kind of a device that sits on your coffee table or something. And then I mean,
well, you don't want a guest having access to all your stuff because,
yeah,
you know, what if somebody says, well, often actually the most often and common request I get when I have guests is, can I log into Facebook on your computer? So it's like, okay, I gotta open a private Windows session. And then it's like, if I just had an iPad on the coffee table where they can log into a guest account,
yeah,
and just, and then it just wipes everything, that would be ideal.
Yeah. And the weird part is OS X's had that forever. They've had a user system with a guest user account for as long as I've been using OS X. Like, I don't know when they first introduced it. It's probably always been there, I would think.
I would imagine from the beginning of OS X, because that was the first, like, thing where, like, we're introducing something that's based on Linux or Unix.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, how could you not have multi-user management with a guest account?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of baked in there really, really deep. So they couldn't not do it. And the funny part is iOS is also based on Linux or Unix. It's a Unix system, just like OS X is. It still runs on the same Darwin kernel that OS X does. So in theory, it would be fairly trivial to add multi-user support because it already exists on OS X. With a little tweaking and a lot of UX work, it would probably be fairly easy.
Well, at this point,
port it over.
It seems like it must be fairly low on their priority list, though, because they clearly just don't seem to care about it.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't need multi-user on an iPhone, for example.
Right.
And iPhone is the moneymaker.
Sure.
So they focus on iPhone development. For the longest time, iPad has kind of taken a back seat, but with the launch of the iPad Pro, with all of this focus on making iPad this productivity device again, I think Apple's really going to go, okay, you know what? Let's take a look at the iPad version of iOS and say to ourselves, okay, if we were starting over again, if we made Pad OS, what would that look like? What extra features would it have that the iPhone doesn't? It's something that I think they've needed to do for a long time, but
I think one of the biggest complaints I see about people that own an iPad Pro is that, okay, guys, you made the screen a hell of a lot bigger and you did nothing to the OS. So now I have these tiny icons spaced apart, like massive gaps between my icons. Like, the grid design is so old, and I would argue the grid design now on a phone, even on the iPhone, is so dated. Like, when I look at what Microsoft did with Metro, I'm like, I'm so impressed with that tile design. It just feels so new and fresh to me.
Yeah.
And I know it's not for everyone, but really, I mean, how many more years do you think we can go with that grid of icons? And the thing is like, even on Android, at least they have a grid of icons, but at least the grid isn't fixed. Like, I can move an icon and put it anywhere. But on an iOS device, the icons snap to a grid. So it's frustrating. I can't just put an icon anywhere that I want.
Well, the reason for that is aesthetic enforcement, which is something Apple does all the time. You're not allowed to do
anything. Not on my Mac. I can have my icons anywhere on my desktop.
That's different. That's grandfathered in. You're not allowed to do anything that makes the operating system ugly.
Right. And there are plenty of, I guess the argument could be made that, I mean, I've seen plenty of people with, you know, with Macs, and their desktop is just littered with shit.
Yeah. And that's why Apple Watch only has a select number of watch faces. That's why they haven't added custom watch faces, because, again, adhering to aesthetic enforcement, you aren't allowed to do anything that makes the software ugly. So allowing custom watch faces would theoretically allow for an ugly Apple Watch, and they don't want that at all. So, and I mean, some people will argue that that's terrible. How dare you? We should be allowed to do whatever we want. But the thing is,
sure, if you want to do whatever you want, go to Android.
Yeah.
That's their answer.
Yeah. Use Android. If you want to mess up your phone and put widgets left and right and everything all over
really,
the place.
A really ugly pink theme on top of Android, sure.
And use Comic Sans as your system font. Like, you want to do all that stuff? Yeah. Go with Android. if you want a clean, smooth phone experience where everything works the way it's supposed to and everything looks and feels great.
Uniform.
iOS. Uniform. Exactly. There's something to be said for it. Like, if I'm unlocking my phone and looking at stuff, I don't want to have to guess where things are. I don't want to have to swipe through pages and pages of things and, like, oh, suddenly this widget is here. Like, that happens a lot on Android. You'll install an app and it'll have a bundled widget with it and it'll just throw it onto the screen.
It's like, I didn't ask for this.
Yeah, exactly.
At least on iOS with Notification Center, you can actually pick which widgets you want to add. They will show up in a list if you edit it, but they don't automatically include it, which I'm so glad Apple enforced, because that would just be bad.
Yeah, like,
I mean, we would have it's really bad. I guess the best example, the best analogy I have is currently push notifications are a mess on iOS because people install an app, they just get this dialogue, this modal that says, do you want to allow push notifications for whatever? And they're like, yes, of course I do. I don't know what it is, but sure. And like, my dad's phone is a perfect example of this. I pick up my dad's phone and he's got like 50 freaking push notifications that are like 2 weeks old that he hasn't cleared. And most of them like, sign in to the app to get, you know, like get this discount. Like, you know, it's just like all these apps do these really disrespectful things that are just ignore people's time. And they just want your attention to buy stuff. And it's fine if you want to opt into that, but to make that the default experience where, like, you know, you're getting, I don't know if it's Groupon or another app. I don't want to single any specific app, but the shopping apps are particularly bad for this. Thankfully, Amazon doesn't do this, but they just send you push notifications of like deal of the week and, you know, just stuff like, it's terrible. And like, my dad doesn't seem to notice or doesn't seem to care. So like, notifications are really bad. And I would never want that with widgets on my screen, on my lock screen. It just, no.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why Apple tries to be a gatekeeper. They go, we know better than you. And I know this sounds really arrogant and horrible, but
they do for the most part. They have sensibilities.
They have taste.
And I think they try to make the most, take the most pragmatic approach. What can we do that will allow the best? I think it all boils down to the user experience.
Yeah.
What can we do that no matter what this person does, they can't, you know, F up their iPhone.
Exactly. Exactly. We will let you do anything you want as long as it doesn't screw things up.
Because I don't know if Android is still like this because it's been quite a while, but I remember back in the early days of Android, I was really confused with it because unlike iOS, now maybe it's just because, you know, going from one OS to another, it's like, okay, I got to relearn everything, fine. But the fact that you could have like unlimited screens that you could swipe, not in just one direction, but left to right. So I didn't realize that if I actually swiped right, which is kind of confusing, but swiping right gets you to the screen that's to the left. So
yeah, see, but anyways, this is where I run into the problem.
Anyways, but yeah, it came prepackaged with these other home screens with app that were littered with icons and like calendar widgets, stuff that I didn't ask for. And of course, you can long press on that home screen and move it up to the trash to completely obliterate that home screen too.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the maximum number of pages is. I think it's like somewhere between 7 and 9.
Yeah. But at least you only have to swipe in one direction, whereas like on Android for the longest time, you could swipe either direction, which I found really weird.
Yeah.
I don't know Android, if it's still like that.
It's still like that. And still like that. And sorry, the 7 to 9, I think is for Android.
Okay.
Not iOS. I'm not actually sure what the limit for iOS is.
I think
it's probably around the same.
I know you can have a lot of pages with a lot of icons.
Yeah.
What happens when you reach the limit and you keep installing apps? Never run into that. Does your phone explode?
No.
And then you get a phone call from Tim Cook.
With iOS, I'm actually not sure. With Android, obviously, they still have the app drawer. So even if you can't add right. new icons to the home screen, you still have that giant scroll list of all your apps.
It's kind of fun to actually scroll through that. It just looks pretty. It's like, wee!
Yeah, until you notice the frame drops.
Not on the new flagship devices. It's not still like that anymore.
No, it's still there.
I haven't noticed that on the new stock Android.
If you see it, you won't be able to unsee it.
I've only seen demos like the flagship phone from Google now, the 6P.
Yeah,
it looked when I watched that
it wouldn't surprise me
video,
if that was good.
That one looked flawless to me.
The Samsung phones are still bad.
No, well, but that's because of TouchWiz and all that other garbage on there, right? So
yeah, of course, stock Android on the 6P. Yeah, it's probably just fine, but it's still going to be imperceptibly not as good as iOS just because of the limitation of Android, which is that Android runs on a virtual machine.
Right. And we've talked about this before, and I don't want to
I know.
Beat a dead horse, but it's always funny to me that like Android phones, and don't get me, this sounds like I'm being a snob. Like, look, I've used both Android and iOS and I like both. And I actually genuinely like Android in its current form on a stock flagship Google device with Android M. I think it's pretty. I think they've solved most of the complaints that I've had in terms of the design aesthetic.
Yeah.
Finally seems to have some kind of cohesive design. Like we know, like I have a clear understanding of where they want this device to be and what they want it to work, how they want it to work and all that sort of stuff. But I've used both devices and I still periodically go back to Android and try it out. But for me, like the fact, I always find it hilarious that these flagship devices have like 6 gillion, like jillion gigabytes of RAM and like 8-core processor. I'm being hyperbolic here, but you know what I mean. It's like the processing and RAM power on these devices is so much superior than an iOS device. Just in pure technical terms, though.
It's not, though.
How so? When you have like a quad core processor with 4 gigabytes of RAM,
and yet a dual core Apple chip beats it in benchmarks.
Mm.
It's but isn't all that because down.
It, I thought
to
it was
design.
All down to Android being the bottleneck, not the hardware itself.
It's both.
Because if you took that quad core chip and ran it on iOS, how would it run? Of course, we have no way of knowing.
It's difficult to say. Ultimately, the benchmarks run on the OS, so obviously you're fighting against Android when you're trying an Android benchmark. But one of the sneaky things that these companies have started doing, Qualcomm and such, they've started building their chips to... They've basically done what Volkswagen does, or did. They've designed their chips to run at maximum power for just long enough for a benchmark test to run. There was a tweet today, actually, about it. The latest Qualcomm chip, it runs for 30 seconds at maximum power, and then it starts fluctuating, as you would expect a normal chip to do. Which means it knows when you're running a benchmark, it cranks it up to maximum, waits for the test to be over, and then it goes back to normal.
Well, that's just cheating.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the benchmarks that we get for iOS versus Android are not accurate at all, basically. Because, like, if that's true, if they specifically design these chips to run at maximum power for a benchmark and then go back to whatever it is normally, then it's not a valid test. You would need to line up average use benchmarks or something to that effect. But routinely, even with the handicap, every new Apple chip always beats every previous Android phone every time. Because Apple... This is one of the big things about Apple now. The fact that they have custom silicon design is probably the most underrated success story of Apple. It's something that years from now we're going to be saying, wow, when they switched to do their own chips, that was the single greatest thing they've ever done. Because as of now, Apple is years ahead of the competition, just in terms of raw processing power, in terms of what they're able to do with all of the coprocessors, all of the additional chipsets, all of the custom things that they're building. It all works together to create a hardware experience that can't really be matched by off-the-shelf hardware. Even using the screaming latest Qualcomm chip, things like Touch ID or Samsung Pay or like whatever these things are, they're much slower than what Apple has to offer. And that's because Apple is building their chipsets with all of these features specifically in mind.
They're being tuned for it.
Yeah. And you only get that when you design the hardware and the software at the same time.
There's no way that they can beat that.
No.
Not until Google takes everything
and
back
they won't.
And takes control over all of that.
They won't and they can't.
Right.
It's too late for that. Like,
not without destroying the ecosystem.
Yeah, and that's the big problem. Like, if Google were to go back and do it all over again, they would probably build Android on something a lot more stable. They wouldn't use the virtual machine. They would just build a brand new system, probably on Unix. They might write it in Go or one of the other languages that they've created. Probably Go, actually. Go is kind of like Swift. So it makes sense for the programming language they would use, but it's far too late for that. Like, for them to now be like, oh yeah, we're going to do a whole new operating system and it's going to be super fast and do all these things, it just wouldn't work. There are just too many Android devices. There's too much OEM support out there. Like, whatever euphemism you want to use, they let the genie out of the bottle, they let the tiger out of the cage, whatever. Like, it's far too late to do anything about it because you have like a billion Android devices out there all running the same code with the same limitations, the same flaws. And on top of that, like, it's open source software. And on top of that, you have all the cruft that the OEMs add, so TouchWiz and all of that other stuff. Then you have the fact that every single phone is using a different subset of off-the-shelf hardware. None of it is designed for the operating system specifically. The operating system isn't designed specifically to be optimized for the parts they're using. It's all just a mismatched jumble of stuff. And that's kind of why they've ramped into this spec war where it's like, okay, now we have an octa-core processor with 8 gigs of RAM. It's because they need it to overcome the limitations of the platform. They need all of that raw power just to make it work fast enough to beat the iPhone. Like, that's what they're doing essentially. Every year, Apple releases the iPhone with the new version of the A chip. And it beats every single phone in benchmarks, even though it's like a dual core and only running at 1 gigahertz. It's still that much faster than octa-core processors and 8 gigs of RAM.
Right.
Because Apple is like, their chip design is so far ahead that they can literally make a dual core 1 gigahertz chip and have it beat 8 core 2 gigahertz chips. Like, that's the difference in the technology that they're working with, where they can optimize something to the point where it's not even that fast and it's still better at the same job.
I guess I never really realized how much overhead there is on Android with that Java virtual machine thing. Is that, technically speaking, is that like a layer of abstraction that's basically causing the bottleneck, all that?
Yeah. Like, on the runaround, you've got the base layer of the hardware, like the metal, the assembly code, and then you've got a Java compiler, and the Java compiler...
So is that an interpreter? Is that the right term for that?
Yeah. So you've got a Java interpreter, and as far as I understand it, then you've got the Java VM that runs Dalvik. And Dalvik is the base layer of Android, but it sits inside the virtual machine. So you've got a program, you've got assembly code running a program, running a virtual machine, running a program inside of the virtual machine, and that's the operating
system.
That
sounds extremely messy.
So you've got the raw metal going through at least three layers just to get to the operating system.
Yeah, no wonder you need all that processing power.
Yeah, like it's like you're in a running race on a treadmill and you have to run five times as hard to get the treadmill to move. or I don't know. Probably a bad metaphor. More like a running race in lead shoes. You have to work five times as hard to go as fast as the other guy. And the other guy being Apple. So that's why we see this like insane ramp up in specs every year, because it's the only thing they can do to keep up. Because Apple just has that edge of not only is our chip design that much far ahead, but also because we have control over everything, the entire device, we can make these optimizations that allow us to do 10 times more work with half the resources, and they just can't do it. Android literally won't let them because of like just all the things. So, I mean, they can throw as many cores as they want. They can throw as much RAM as they want. But in the end, Apple is always going to have a better chip. They're always going to have a more efficient operating system just because they made all the right choices and all the right calls. And now they're building their own hardware. They made long-term investments and it's paying off.
That's it for this week. You've been listening to The Impromptu. I'm here with Michael Norton, as always, and I'm Alex Knight. You can follow us on Twitter at The Impromptu. And, of course, if you have a moment, we would sincerely appreciate you leaving a rating for us in iTunes. Why do you want to do that? Well, it helps other people find the show. And it's generally a good thing to do. If you'd like to show your support for the show, you can go to hologramradio.org/donate and donate a couple of bucks, whatever you feel comfortable with. And of course, go to our sponsors page, which also helps us out as well. We've got links for Amazon UK, US, and Canada. And if you click on those links, it's the exact same shopping experience that you know and love. You don't have to do anything differently, except that when you buy something, everybody here gets a portion of the sale as a commission, which is fantastic for us. So we can keep making these episodes free. If you'd like to leave feedback for us, you can do that as well. Go to our contact page on the website and you'll find an email address, which is actually theimpromptu@hologramradio.org.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.